and yet...
As the cable car ascended, Nicole pulled her snow glasses down over her eyes. It was a dazzling morning, not unlike the January morning 7 years earlier when her father had called for her from the villa. They had had a rare snowfall at Beauvoir the night before, and, after much pleading, she had let Genevieve stay home from school to play in the snow. Nicole was working at the hospital in Tours at the time, and was waiting to hear about her application to the Space Academy. She had been showing her 7-year-old daughter how to make a snow angel when Pierre had called a second time from the house.
"Nicole, Genevieve, there's something special in our mail," he had said. "It must have come during the night."
Nicole and Genevieve had run to the villa in their snowsuits, while Pierre posted the full text of the message on the wall video screen.
"Most extraordinary," Pierre had said. "It seems we've all been invited to the English coronation, including the private reception afterwards. This is extremely unusual."
"Oh, Grandpapa,"
Genevieve said excitedly.
"I want to go. Can we go? Do I get to meet a real king and queen?"
"There's no queen, darling," her grandfather replied, "unless you mean the queen mother. This king has not yet married."
Nicole read the invitation several times without saying anything. After Genevieve had calmed down and left the room, her father had put his arms around Nicole.
"I want to go," she had said, quietly.
"Are you certain?" he had asked,
pulling away and regarding her with an inquisitive stare.
"Yes," she had answered firmly.
Henry had never seen her until that evening, Nicole was thinking, as she checked first her watch and then her equipment in preparation for her ski run down from the summit. "Father had been wonderful. He had let me disappear at Beauvoir, and almost nobody knew I had a baby until Genevieve was almost a year old. Henry never even suspected. Not until that night at Buckingham Palace." Nicole could still see herself waiting in the reception line. The king had been late. Genevieve had been fidgety. At last, Henry had been standing opposite her.
"The Honorable Pierre de Jardin of Beauvoir, France, with his daughter Nicole and granddaughter Genevieve."
Nicole had bowed very properly, and Genevieve had curtsied.
"So, this is Genevieve," the king had said.
He had bent down for only a moment and put a hand under the child's chin. When the girl had lifted up her face, he had seen something that he recognized. He had turned to look at Nicole, a trace of questioning in his glance. Nicole had revealed nothing with her smile. The crier was calling out the names of the next guests in the line. The king had moved on. "So you sent Darren to the hotel," Nicole thought, as she shushed a short slope, aimed for a small jump, and was airborne for a second or two. "And he hummed and hawed, and finally asked me if I would come have tea." Nicole dug her edges into the snow and came to an abrupt stop.
"Tell Henry I can't,"
she remembered saying to Darren in London 7 years earlier. She looked again at her watch. It was only 11 o'clock, too early to ski to the hut. She eased over to one of the lifts and took another ride to the summit. It was 2 minutes past noon when Nicole arrived at the small chalet on the edge of the woods. She took off her skis, stuck them in the snow, and walked toward the front door. She ignored the conspicuous signs all around her that said Eintritt verboten. From out of nowhere came two burly men, one of whom actually jumped between Nicole and the door to the hut.
"It's all right," she heard a familiar voice say. "We're expecting her."
The two guards vanished as quickly as they had appeared, and Nicole saw Darren, smiling as always, occupying the doorway to the chalet.
"Hi there, Nicole," he said in his normal, friendly fashion.
Darren had aged. There were a few flecks of grey around his temples and some salt with the pepper in his short beard.
"How are you?"
he asked.
"I'm fine, Darren," she answered,
aware that despite all her lectures to herself, she was already starting to feel nervous. She reminded herself that she was now a professional, as accomplished in her own way as this king she was about to see. Nicole then strode forcefully into the chalet. It was warm inside. Henry was standing with his back to a small fireplace. Darren closed the door behind her and left the two of them alone. Nicole self-consciously removed her scarf and opened her parka. She took off her snow glasses. They stared at each other for 20, maybe 30 seconds, neither saying a word, neither wanting to interrupt the powerful flow of emotions that was carrying each of them back to 2 magnificent days 15 years before.
"Hello, Nicole,"
the king said finally. His voice was soft and tender.
Hello, Henry, she replied.
He started to walk around the couch, to come close to her, perhaps to touch her. But there was something in her body language that stopped him. He leaned on the side of the couch.
Won't you sit down? He invited.
Nicole shook her head.
I'd prefer to stand if it's all right with you.
She waited a few more seconds, their eyes again locked in a deep communication. She felt herself being drawn to him, despite her strong internal warnings.
Henry, she blurted out suddenly, why did you summon me here?
It must be important. It's not normal for the King of England to spend his days sitting in a chalet on the side of a Swiss ski mountain.
Henry walked towards the corner of the room.
I brought you a present, he said, as he bent down with his back to Nicole.
In honor of your 36th birthday.
Nicole laughed. Some of the tension was easing.
That's tomorrow, she said. You're a day early. But why?
He extended a data cube toward her.
This is the most valuable gift I could find for you, he said seriously. And it has taken many marks from the Royal Treasury to compile it.
She looked at him quizzically.
I have been worried for some time about this mission of yours, Henry said, and in the beginning I could not understand why. But about 4 months ago, one night when I was playing with Prince Charles and Princess Eleanor, I realized what was bothering me. My intuitive sense tells me that this crew of yours will have problems. I know it sounds crazy, particularly coming from me, but I'm not worried about the Rahmans. That megalomaniac Brown is probably right. The Rahmans couldn't care less about us Earthlings. But you're about to spend 100 days in confined quarters with 11 other...
He could tell that Nicole was not following him.
Here, he said, take this cube. I had my intelligence agents put together full and complete dossiers on every member of the Newton Dozen, including you.
Nicole's brow furrowed.
The information, most of which is not available in the official ISA files, confirmed my personal view that the Newton team contains quite a few unstable elements. I didn't know what to do with...
This is none of your business, Nicole interrupted angrily.
She was affronted by Henry's involvement in her professional life.
Why are you meddling?
Hey, hey, calm down, will you? The king replied. I assure you my motives were all good.
Look, he added,
you probably won't even need all this information, but I thought that maybe it could be useful. Take it. Throw it away if you like. You're the life science officer. You can treat it however you want.
Henry could tell that he had botched the meeting. He walked away and sat down in a chair facing the fire. His back was toward Nicole.
Take care of yourself, Nicole, he mumbled.
She thought for a long moment, put the data cube inside her parka, and walked over behind the king.
Thank you, Henry, she said.
Nicole let her hand fall on his shoulder. He didn't turn around. He reached up with his hand and very slowly wrapped his fingers around hers. They remained in that position for almost a minute.
There was some data that eluded even my investigators, he said in a low voice. One fact in particular in which I was extremely interested.
Nicole could hear her heart amid the crackle of the logs in the fireplace. A voice inside her shouted, tell him, tell him. But another voice, full of wisdom, counseled silence. She slowly withdrew her fingers from his. He turned around to look at her. She smiled. Nicole walked over to the door. She put her scarf back on her head and zipped her parka before going outside.
Goodbye, Henry, she said.
Chapter 15 Encounter. The combined Newton spacecraft had maneuvered so that Rama filled the expanded viewpoint in the control center. The alien spaceship was immense. Its surface was a dull, drab gray, and its long body was a geometrically perfect cylinder. Nicole stood beside Valeri Bortsov in silence. For each of them, this first sight of the entire Rama vehicle in the sunlight was a moment to savor.
Have you detected any differences?
Nicole said at length.
Not yet,
Commander Bortsov replied.
It looks as if the two of them came off the same assembly line.
They were quiet again.
Wouldn't you love to see that assembly line?
Nicole asked. Valeri Bortsov nodded. A small flying craft, like a bat or a hummingbird, zoomed past the viewport in the near field and headed off in the direction of Rama.
The exterior drones will confirm the similarities. Each of them has a stored set of images from Rama 1. Any variation will be logged and reported within 3 hours.
And if there are no unexplained variations?
Then we proceed as planned. General Bortsov answered with a smile. We dock, open up Rama, and release the interior drones. He glanced at his watch, all of which should take place about 22 hours from now, provided the life science officer asserts that the crew is ready.
The crew is in fine shape, Nicole reported. I've just finished looking at a synopsis of the crew's health data again. It's been surprisingly regular. Except for hormonal abnormalities in all 3 women, which were not totally unexpected, we have seen no significant anomalies in 40 days.
So, physically, we're all ready to go, the commander said thoughtfully. But what about our psychological readiness? Are you troubled about this recent spate of arguments, or can we chalk it up to tension and excitement?
Nicole was silent for a moment.
I agree these 4 days since the docking have been a little rough. Of course, we knew about the Wilson-Brown problem even before launch. We partially solved it by having Reggie on your ship during most of the cruise, but now that we've joined the 2 spacecraft and the team is all together again, those 2 seem to be at each other at every opportunity.
Particularly if Francesca is around.
I tried to talk to Wilson twice while the 2 ships were separated, Bortsov said in a frustrated tone. He wouldn't discuss it, but it's clear that he is very angry about something.
General Bortsov walked over to the control panel and started fiddling with the keyboards. Sequencing information appeared on one of the monitors.
It must involve Sabatini, he continued. Wilson didn't do much work during cruise, but his log indicates that he spent an inordinate amount of time on the video phone with her. And he was always in a foul mood. He even offended O'Toole.
General Bortsov turned and looked intently at Nicole.
As my life science officer, I want to know if you have any official recommendations about the crew, especially with respect to psychological interactions among the team members.
Nicole had not expected this. When General Bortsov had scheduled this final crew health assessment with her, she had not thought that the meeting would extend to the mental health of the Newton Dozen as well.
You're asking for a professional psychological evaluation also? She asked.
Certainly, General Bortsov replied. I want an A5401 from you that attests to both the physical and psychological readiness of every one of the crew members. The procedure clearly states that the commanding officer before each sortie should request crew certification from the life science officer.
But during the simulations you asked only for physical health data.
Bortsov smiled. I can wait, Madame de Jada, he said, if you'd like time to prepare your report.
No, no,
Nicole said after some reflection. I can give my opinions now and then officially document them later tonight.
She hesitated several more seconds before continuing.
I wouldn't put Wilson and Brown together as crew members on any sub-team. At least not in the first sortie. And I'd even have some qualms, although this opinion is certainly not as strong, about combining Francesca in a group with either of the 2 men. I would place no other limitations of any kind on this crew.
Good, good. The commander grinned broadly. I appreciate your report, and not just because it confirms my own opinions. As you can understand, these matters can sometimes be fairly delicate.
General Bortsov abruptly changed the subject.
Now, I have another question of an altogether different nature to ask you.
What's that?
Francesca came to me this morning and suggested that we have a party tomorrow night. She contends that the crew is tense and in need of some kind of release before the first sortie inside Rama. Do you agree with her?
Nicole reflected for a moment.
It's not a bad idea, she replied.
The strain has been definitely showing. But what kind of party did you have in mind?
A dinner, all together, here in the control room. Some wine and vodka. Maybe even a little entertainment.
Bortsov smiled and put his arm on Nicole's shoulder.
I'm asking your professional opinion, you understand, as my life science officer.
Of course, Nicole said with a laugh.
General, she added, if you think it's time for the crew to have a party, then I'd be delighted to lend a hand.
Nicole finished her report and transferred the file by data line over to Bortsov's computer in the military ship. She had been very careful in her language to identify the problem as a personality conflict, rather than any kind of behavioral pathology. To Nicole, the problem between Wilson and Brown was straightforward. Jealousy, pure and simple, the ancient green-eyed monster itself. She was certain that it was wise to prevent Wilson and Brown from working closely together during sorties inside Rama. Nicole chastised herself for not having raised the issue with Bortsov on her own. She realized that her mission portfolio included mental health as well, but somehow she had difficulty thinking of herself as the crew psychiatrist. I avoid it because it's not an objective process, she thought. We have no sensors yet to measure good or bad mental health. Nicole walked down the hall of the living area. She was careful to keep one foot on the floor at all times. She was so accustomed to the weightless environment that it was almost second nature. Nicole was glad that the Newton design engineers had worked so hard to minimize the differences between being in space and on the Earth. It had made the job of being a cosmonaut much simpler by allowing the crew to concentrate on the more important elements of their work. Nicole's room was at the end of the corridor. Although each of the cosmonauts had private quarters, the result of heated arguments between the crew and the system's engineers, the latter having insisted that sleeping in pairs was a more efficient use of the space, the rooms were very small and confining. There were 8 bedrooms on this larger vehicle, called the scientific ship by the crew members. The military ship had 4 more small bedrooms. Both spacecraft also had exercise rooms and lobbies, common rooms where there was more comfortable furniture, as well as some entertainment options not available in the bedrooms. As Nicole passed Janos Taburi's room on her way to the exercise area, she heard his unmistakable laugh. His door was open as usual.
"Did you really expect me," Janos was saying, "to trade bishops and leave your knights in command of the center of the board? Come on, Shig, I may not be a master, but I do learn from my mistakes. I fell for that one in an earlier game."
Taburi and Takagishi were involved in their usual postprandial chess match. Almost every night, the crew had stayed on a 24-hour day that coincided with Greenwich Mean Time, the two men played for an hour or so before sleeping. Takagishi was a ranked chess master, but he was also soft-hearted and wanted to encourage Taburi. So, in virtually every game, after establishing a solid position, Takagishi would allow his edge to be eroded. Nicole stuck her head in the door.
"Come in, beautiful," Janos said with a grin. "Watch me destroy our Asiatic friend in this pseudo-cerebral endeavor."
Nicole had started to explain that she was going to the exercise room when a strange creature, about the size of a big mouse, scurried through her legs and into Tabori's room. She jumped back involuntarily as the toy, or whatever it was, headed for the two men.
"The ousel cock so black of hue with orange tawny bill, the throstle with his note so true, the wren with little quill."
The robot was singing as it skipped towards Janos. Nicole dropped down on her knees and examined the curious newcomer. It had the lower body of a human and the head of a donkey. It continued to sing. Taburi and Takagishi stopped their game and both laughed at the bewildered expression on Nicole's face.
"Go on," said Janos. "Tell him that you love him. That's what the Fairy Queen Titania would do."
Nicole shrugged her shoulders. The little robot was temporarily quiet. As Janos urged again, Nicole mumbled, "I love you," to the 20-centimeter Athenian with a mule's head. The miniature bottom turned to Nicole.
"Methinks, mistress, you should have little reason for that. And yet, to say the truth, reason and love keep little company together nowadays."
Nicole was amazed. She reached out to pick up the tiny figure, but stopped herself when she heard another voice.
"Lord, what fools these mortals be. Now where is that player I changed into an ass? Bottom, where art thou?"
A second small robot, this one dressed as an elf, leapt into the room. When he saw Nicole, he jumped up from the floor and hovered at eye level for several seconds, his tiny back wings beating at a frantic pace.
"I be Puck, fair lass," he said. "I've not seen thee before."
The robot dropped to the ground and was silent. Nicole was now dumbfounded.
"What in the world?" she started to say.
"Shh," Janos said, motioning for her to be quiet. He pointed at Puck. Bottom was sleeping in the corner near the edge of Janos's bed. Puck had now found Bottom and was spraying him with a fine light dust from a small pouch. As the three human beings watched, Bottom's head began to change. Nicole could tell that the small plastic and metal pieces making up the ass's head were simply rearranging themselves, but even she was impressed by the scope of the metamorphosis. Puck scampered off just as Bottom awakened with his new human head and started talking.
"I have had a most rare vision,"
Bottom said.
I have had a dream. Past the wit of man to say what dream it was. Man is but an ass if he go about to expound this dream.
Bravo, bravo,
Janos shouted, as the creature fell silent.
Omadetio, Takagishi added.
Nicole sat down in the single unoccupied chair and looked at her companions.
And to think, she said, shaking her head, that I actually told the commander you two were psychologically sound.
She paused 2 or 3 seconds.
Would one of you please tell me what is going on here?
It's Wakefield,
Janos said.
The man is absolutely brilliant, and unlike some geniuses, also very clever. In addition, he's a Shakespeare fanatic. He has a whole family of these little guys, although I think Puck is the only one that flies, and Bottom's the only one that changes shape.
Puck doesn't fly, Richard Wakefield said, coming into the room. He is barely capable of hovering, and only for a short period. Wakefield seemed embarrassed.
I didn't know you were going to be here, he said to Nicole.
Sometimes I entertain these two in the middle of their chess game.
One night,
Janos added, as Nicole remained speechless.
I had just conceded defeat to Shig when we heard what we thought was a fracas in the hall. Moments later, Tybalt and Mercutio entered the room, swearing and slashing their swords at each other.
This is a hobby of yours?
Nicole asked after several seconds, indicating the robots with a wave of her hand.
My lady, Janos interrupted before Wakefield could answer. Never, never mistake a passion for a hobby. Our esteemed Japanese scientist does not play chess as a hobby. And this young man from the Bard's hometown of Stratford-on-Avon does not create these robots as a hobby.
Nicole glanced at Richard. She was trying to imagine the amount of energy and work that was necessary for the creation of sophisticated robots like the ones she had just seen. Not to mention talent and, of course, passion.
Very impressive, she said to Wakefield.
His smile acknowledged her compliment. Nicole excused herself and started to leave the room. Puck zoomed around her and stood in the doorway.
If we shadows have offended, think but this, and all is mended, that you have but slumbered here while these visions did appear.
Nicole was laughing as she stepped over the sprite and waved good night to her friends. Nicole stayed in the exercise room longer than she expected. Ordinarily, 30 minutes of hard bicycling or running in place was enough to release her tensions and relax her body for sleep. On this evening, however, with the goal of their mission now so close at hand, it was necessary for her to work out for a longer time to calm her hyperactive system. Part of her difficulty was her residual concern about the report she had filed recommending that Wilson and Brown be separated on all important mission activities. Was I too hasty? She asked herself. Did I let General Bortsov sway my opinion? Nicole was very proud of her professional reputation, and often constructively second-guessed her major decisions. Toward the end of her exercise, she convinced herself again that she had filed the proper report. Her tired body told her that it was ready to sleep. When she returned to the living area in the spacecraft, it was dark everywhere except in the hallway. As she started to turn left into the corridor that led to her room, she happened to glance beyond the lobby, in the direction of the small room where she kept all the medical supplies. That's strange, she thought, straining her eyes in the dim light. It looks as if I left the supply room door open. Nicole walked across the lobby. The supply door was indeed ajar. She had already activated the automatic lock and had started to close the door when she heard a noise inside the dark room. Nicole reached in and turned on the light. She surprised Francesca Sabatini, who was sitting in the corner at a computer terminal. There was information displayed on the monitor in front of her, and Francesca was holding a thin bottle in one of her hands.
"Oh, hello, Nicole,"
Francesca said nonchalantly, as if it were normal for her to be sitting in the dark at the computer in the medical supply room. Nicole walked slowly over to the computer.
"What's going on?"
she said casually, her eyes scanning the information on the screen. From the coded headings, Nicole could tell that Francesca had requested the inventory subroutine to list the birth control devices available on board the spacecraft.
"What is this?"
Nicole now asked, pointing at the monitor. There was a trace of irritation in her voice. All the cosmonauts knew that the medical supply room was off-limits to everyone but the life science officer. When Francesca still did not reply, Nicole became angry.
"How did you get in here?"
she demanded. The two women were only a few centimeters apart in the small alcove next to the desk. Nicole suddenly reached over and grabbed the bottle out of Francesca's hand. While Nicole was reading the label, Francesca pushed her way through the narrow space and headed for the door. Nicole discovered that the liquid in her hand was for inducing abortions, and quickly followed Francesca into the lobby.
"Are you going to explain this?" Nicole asked. "Just give me the bottle, please," Francesca said finally.
"I can't do that," answered Nicole, shaking her head.
"This is a very strong medicine with serious side effects. What did you think you were going to do? Steal it and have it pass unnoticed?
As soon as I completed an inventory comparison, I would have known that it was gone."
The two women stared at each other for several seconds.
"Look, Nicole,"
Francesca said at length, managing a smile,
"this is really a very simple matter. I have discovered recently, much to my chagrin, that I am in the very early stages of pregnancy. I wish to abort the embryo. It's a private matter, and I did not want to involve you or any of the rest of the crew."
"You can't be pregnant," Nicole replied quickly.
"I would have seen it in your biometry data." "I'm only 4 or 5 days, but I'm certain. I can already feel the changes in my body, and it's the right time of the month."
"You know the proper procedures for medical problems," Nicole said, after some hesitation.
"This might have been very simple, to use your phrase, if you had first come to me. Most likely I would have respected your request for confidentiality, but now you have given me a dilemma." "Will you stop with a bureaucratic lecture?" Francesca interrupted sharply. "I'm not really interested in the goddamn rules. A man has made me pregnant and I intend to remove the fetus. Now, are you going to give me the bottle, or must I find another way?"
Nicole was outraged.
"You are amazing," she responded to Francesca. "Do you really expect me to hand you this bottle and walk away, without asking any questions? You may be that cavalier about your life and health, but I certainly am not. I have to examine you first, check your medical history, determine the age of the embryo. Only then would I even consider prescribing this medicine for you. Besides, I would feel compelled as well to point out to you that there are moral and psychological ramifications."
Francesca laughed out loud.
"Spare me your ramifications, Nicole. I don't need your upper-class bourgeois morality passing judgment on my life. Congratulations to you for raising a child as a single parent. My situation is much different. The father of this baby purposely stopped taking his pills, thinking my being pregnant would rekindle my love for him. He was wrong. This baby is unwanted. Now, should I be more graphic?"
"That's enough," Nicole interrupted, pursing her lips in disgust. "The details of your personal life are really none of my business. I must decide what is best for you and for the mission." She paused.
"In any event, I must insist on a proper examination, including the normal pelvic internal image set. If you refuse, then I won't authorize the abortion. And of course, I'd be forced to make a complete report."
Francesca laughed.
"You don't need to threaten me. I am not that stupid. If it will make you feel better to stick your fancy equipment between my legs, then be my guest. But let's do it. I want this baby out of me before the sortie."
Nicole and Francesca hardly exchanged a dozen words during the next hour. They went together to the small infirmary, where Nicole used her sensitive instruments to verify the existence and size of the embryo. She also tested Francesca for her acceptability to receive the abortion liquid. The fetus had been growing inside Francesca for 5 days.
"Who might you be?" Nicole thought, as she looked on the monitor at the microscopic image of the tiny sac embedded in the walls of the uterus.
Even in the microscope on the probe, there was no way to tell that the collection of cells was a living thing. "But you are already alive, and much of your future is already programmed by your genes." Nicole made the printer list for Francesca what she could expect physically once she had ingested the medicine. The fetus would be swept away, rejected by her body, within 24 hours. There could possibly be some slight cramping with the normal menstruation that would follow immediately. Francesca drank the liquid without hesitation. As her patient was dressing, Nicole thought back to the time when she had first suspected her own pregnancy. "Never once did I consider. And not just because her father was a prince. No. It was a question of responsibility. And love."
"I can tell what you're thinking," Francesca said when she was ready to leave.
She was standing by the infirmary door. "But don't waste your time. You have enough problems of your own." Nicole did not reply.
"So, tomorrow the little bastard will be gone,"
Francesca said coldly, her eyes tired and angry.
"It's a damn good thing.
The world doesn't need another half-black baby. Francesca didn't wait for Nicole's response. Chapter 16. Rama Rama, Burning Bright. The touchdown near the entry port to Rama was smooth and without incident. Following the precedent of Commander Norton 70 years earlier, General Bortsov instructed Yamanaka and Turgenev to guide the Newton to a contact point just outside the 100-meter circular disk, centered on the spin axis of the giant cylinder. A set of low pillbox-shaped structures temporarily held the spacecraft from Earth in place against the slight centrifugal force created by the spinning Rama. Within 10 minutes, strong attachments anchored the Newton firmly to its target. The large disk was, as anticipated, the outer seal of the Raman airlock. Wakefield and Tabori departed from the Newton in their EVA gear and started searching for an embedded wheel. The wheel, which was the manual control for the airlock, was in exactly the predicted place. It turned as expected and exposed an opening in the outer shell of Rama. Since nothing about Rama 2 had yet varied from its predecessor in any way, the two cosmonauts continued with the entry procedure. 4 hours later, after considerable shuttling back and forth in the half-kilometer of corridors and tunnels that connected the great hollow interior of the alien spaceship to the external airlock, the two men had finished opening the 3 redundant cylindrical doors. They had also deployed the transportation system that would ferry people and equipment from the Newton to the inside of Rama. This ferry had been designed by the engineers on Earth to slide along the parallel grooves the Ramans had cut into the walls of the outer tunnels, unknown ages ago. After a short break for lunch, Yamanaka joined Wakefield and Tabori, and the 3 of them constructed the planned Alpha Communications relay station at the inside end of the tunnel. The patterns of the arrayed antennae had been carefully engineered so that, if the second Raman vehicle was identical to the first, two-way communication would be possible between cosmonauts located anywhere on the stairways or in the northern half of the central plane. The master communication plan called for the establishment of another major relay station, to be called Beta, near the cylindrical sea. The pair of stations would provide strong links everywhere in the northern hemicylinder, and would even extend to the island of New York. Brown and Takagishi took their positions in the control center once the operation of the Alpha relay station was verified. The countdown to interior drone deployment proceeded. Takagishi was obviously both nervous and excited as he finished his pre-flight tests with his drone. Brown seemed relaxed, even casual, as he completed his final preparations. Francesca Sabatini was sitting in front of the multiple monitors, ready to select the best images for real-time transmission to the Earth. General Bortsov himself announced the major events in the sequence. He paused for a dramatic breath before issuing the command to activate the 2 drones. The drones then flew away into the dark emptiness of Rama. Seconds later, the main screen in the control center, whose picture came directly from the drone being commanded by David Brown, was flooded with light as the first flare ignited. When the light became more manageable, the outline of the first wide-angle shot could be seen. It had always been planned that this initial picture would be a composite of the northern hemisphere, covering all the territory from the bowl-shaped end where they had entered down to the cylindrical sea at the midpoint of the artificial world. The sharp image that was eventually frozen on the screen was overwhelming. It was one thing to read about Rama and to conduct simulations inside its replica. It was quite another to be anchored to the gigantic spaceship near the orbit of Venus and to be taking a first look inside. That the vista was familiar barely lessened the wonder of the image. In the end of the crater-shaped bowl, starting from the tunnels, a complex of terraces and ramps fanned out until they reached the main body of the spinning cylinder. Trisecting this bowl were 3 wide ladders, resembling broad railroad tracks, each of which later expanded into enormous stairways with more than 30,000 steps each. The ladder-stairway combinations resembled 3 equally spaced ribs of an umbrella, and provided a way to ascend or descend from the flat bottom of the crater to the vast central plain wrapped around the wall of the spinning cylinder. The northern half of the central plain spread out to fill most of the picture on the screen. The huge expanse was broken into rectangular fields that had irregular dimensions except immediately around the cities. The 3 cities in the wide-angle image, clusters of tall, slim objects resembling man-made buildings that were connected by what looked like highways running along the edges of the fields, were immediately recognized by the crew as the Paris, Rome, and London, named by the first Raman explorers. Equally striking in the image were the long straight grooves or valleys of the central plain. These three linear trenches, 10 kilometers long and 100 meters wide, were equally spaced around the curve of Rama. During the first Raman encounter, these valleys had been the sources of the light that had filled the worldlet shortly after the melting of the cylindrical sea. The strange sea, a body of water running completely around the huge cylinder, was at the far edge of the image. It was still frozen, as expected, and in its center was the mysterious island of towering skyscrapers that had been called New York since its original discovery. The skyscrapers stretched off the end of the picture, the looming towers beckoning to be visited. The entire crew stared silently at the image for almost a minute. Then Dr. David Brown started hooting. "All right, Rama," he said in a proud voice. "You see, are you disbelievers?" he shouted loud enough for everyone to hear. "It is exactly like the first one." Francesca's video camera turned to record Brown's exultation. Most of the rest of the crew were still speechless, transfixed by the details on the monitor. Meanwhile, Takagishi's drone was transmitting narrow-angle photos of the area just under the tunnel. These images were featured on the smaller screens around the control center. The pictures would be used to re-verify the designs of the communication and transportation infrastructure to be established inside Rama. This was the real job of this phase of the mission. Comparing the thousands of pictures that would be taken by these drones to the existing camera mosaics from Rama 1. Although most of the comparisons could be done digitally, and therefore automatically, there would always be differences that would require human explanation. Even if the two spaceships were identical, the differing light levels at the times the images were taken would create some artificial miscompares. 2 hours later, the last of the drones returned to the relay station, and an initial summary of the photographic survey was complete. There were no major structural differences between Rama 2 and the earlier space vehicle, down to a scale of 100 meters. The only significant region of miscompares at that resolution was the cylindrical sea itself, and ice reflectivity was a notoriously difficult phenomenon to handle with a straightforward digital comparison algorithm. It had been a long and exciting day. Botsov announced that the crew assignments for the first sortie would be posted in an hour, and that a special dinner would be served in the control center 2 hours later. "You cannot do this!" an angry David Brown shouted, bursting into the commander's office without knocking, and brandishing a hard copy printout of the first sortie assignments.
"What are you talking about?"
General Botsov responded. He was annoyed by Dr. Brown's rude entrance.
"There must be some kind of mistake,"
Brown continued in a loud voice.
"You can't really expect me to stay here on the Newton during the first sortie."
When there was no response from General Botsov, the American scientist changed tactics.
"I want you to know that I don't accept this, and the ISA management won't like it either."
Botsov stood up behind his desk.
"Close the door, Dr. Brown," he said calmly.
David Brown slammed the sliding door.
"Now you listen to me for a minute," the general continued. "I don't give a damn who you know. I am the commanding officer of this mission. If you continue to act like a prima donna, I'll see to it you never set foot inside Rama."
Brown lowered his voice.
"But I demand an explanation," he said, with undisguised hostility. "I am the senior scientist on this mission. I am also the leading spokesman for the Newton Project among the media. How can you possibly justify leaving me on board the Newton while 9 other cosmonauts go inside Rama?"
"I don't have to justify my actions,"
Botsov replied, for the moment enjoying his power over the arrogant American. He leaned forward.
"But for the record, and because I anticipated this childish outburst of yours, I will tell you why you're not going on the first sortie. There are 2 major purposes for our first visit: to establish the communications transportation infrastructure, and to complete a detailed survey of the interior, ensuring that this spaceship is exactly like the first one."
"That's already been confirmed by the drones,"
Brown interrupted.
"Not according to Dr. Takagishi,"
Botsov rebutted.
"He says that."
"Shit, General. Takagishi won't be satisfied until every square centimeter of Rama has been shown to be exactly the same as the first ship. You saw the results of the drone survey. Do you have any doubt in your mind?"
David Brown stopped himself in mid-sentence. General Botsov was drumming on his desk with his fingers and regarding Dr. Brown with a cold stare.
"Are you going to let me finish now?"
Bortsov said at length. He waited a few more seconds.
"Whatever you may think," the commander continued, "Dr. Takagishi is considered to be the world expert on the interior of Rama. You cannot argue even for a minute that your knowledge of the details approaches his. I need all five of the space cadets for the infrastructure work. The two journalists must go inside, not only because there are two separate tasks, but also because world attention is focused on us at this time. Finally, I believe it is important for my subsequent management of this mission that I myself go inside at least once, and I choose to do it now. Since the procedures clearly state that at least three members of the crew must remain outside Rama during the early sorties, it is not difficult to figure out."
"You don't fool me for a minute," David Brown now interrupted nastily. "I know what this is all about. You've concocted an apparently logical excuse to hide the real reason for my exclusion from the first sortie team. You're jealous, Bortsov. You can't stand the fact that I'm regarded by most people as the real leader of this mission."
The commander stared at the scientist for over 15 seconds without saying anything.
"Do you know, Brown," he said finally, "I feel sorry for you. You are remarkably talented, but your talent is exceeded by your own opinion of it. If you weren't such a—"
This time it was Bortsov's turn to stop himself in mid-sentence. He looked away.
"Incidentally, since I know that you will go back to your room and immediately whine to the ISA, I should probably tell you that the Life Science Officer's fitness report explicitly recommends against your sharing any mission duties with Wilson, because of the personal animosity that both of you had demonstrated."
Brown's eyes narrowed. "Are you telling me that Nicole Desjardins actually filed an official memorandum citing Wilson and me by name?" Bortsov nodded.
"The bitch,"
Brown muttered.
"It's always someone else who is at fault, isn't it, Dr. Brown?" General Bortsov said, smiling at his adversary. David Brown turned around and stalked out of the office.
For the banquet, General Bortsov ordered a few precious bottles of wine to be opened. The commanding officer was in an excellent mood. Francesca's suggestion had been a good one. There was a definite feeling of camaraderie among the cosmonauts as they brought the small tables together in the control center and anchored them to the floor. Dr. David Brown did not come to the banquet. He remained in his room while the other 11 crew members feasted on game hens and wild rice. Francesca awkwardly reported that Brown was feeling under the weather. But when Janos Tabori playfully volunteered to go check the American scientist's health, Francesca hurriedly added that Dr. Brown wanted to be left alone. Janos and Richard Wakefield, both of whom had several glasses of wine, bantered with Francesca at one end of the table, while Reggie Wilson and General O'Toole engaged in animated discussion about the coming baseball season at the opposite end. Nicole sat between General Bortsov and Admiral Heilman and listened to their reminiscences of peacekeeping activities in the early post-chaos days. When the meal was over, Francesca excused herself. She and Dr. Takagishi disappeared for several minutes. When they returned, Francesca asked the cosmonauts to turn their chairs to face the large screen. Then, with the lights out, she and Takagishi projected a full exterior view of Rama on the monitor. Except that this was not the dull gray cylinder everyone had seen before. No, this Rama had been cleverly colored, using image processing subroutines, and was now a black cylinder with yellow-gold stripes. The end of the cylinder looked almost like a face. There was a momentary quiet in the room before Francesca began to recite.
"Tiger, tiger, burning bright, in the forests of the night, what immortal hand or eye could frame thy fearful symmetry?"
Nicole Desjardins felt a cold chill run up her spine as she listened to Francesca begin the next verse.
"In what distant deeps or skies burnt the fire of thine eyes?"
That is the real question, after all, Nicole was thinking. Who made this gargantuan spacecraft? That's much more important for our ultimate destiny than why.
"What the hammer? What the chain? In what furnace was thy brain? What the anvil? What dread grasp dare its deadly terrors clasp?"
Across the table, General O'Toole was also mesmerized by Francesca's recitation. His mind was again struggling with the same fundamental questions that had been bothering him since he originally applied for the mission. Dear God, he was wondering, how do these Ramans fit into your universe? Did you create them first? Before us? Are they our cousins in some sense? Why have you sent them here at this time? When the stars threw down their spears and warted heaven with their tears, did he smile his work to see? Did he who made the lamb make thee? When Francesca finished the short poem, there was a brief silence, and then spontaneous applause. She graciously mentioned that Dr. Takagishi had provided all the image processing intelligence, and the likable Japanese cosmonaut took an embarrassed bow. Then Janos Tabori stood at his chair. I think I speak for all of us, Shiga and Francesca, in congratulating you on that original and thought-provoking performance, he said with a grin. It almost, but not quite, made me feel serious about what we are doing tomorrow.
Speaking of which, General Bortsov said, rising at the head of the table with his recently opened bottle of Ukrainian vodka, from which he had already taken two strong swigs. It is now time for an ancient Russian tradition. The toasts! I brought along only two bottles of this national treasure, and I propose to share them both with you, my comrades and colleagues, on this very special evening.
He placed both bottles in General O'Toole's hands, and the American adroitly used a liquid dispenser to channel the vodka into small, covered cups that were passed around the table.
As Irina Turgenev knows, the commander continued, there is always a small worm in the bottom of a bottle of Ukrainian vodka. Legend has it that he who eats the worm will be endowed with special powers for 24 hours. Admiral Heilman has marked two of the cup bottoms with an infrared cross. The two people who drink from the marked cups will each be allowed to eat one of the vodka-saturated worms.
Yuck, said Janos a moment later, as he passed the infrared scanner to Nicole.
He had first verified that he had no cross on the bottom of his cup.
This is one contest I am glad to lose.
Nicole's cup did have a marking on the bottom. She was one of the two lucky cosmonauts who would be able to eat a Ukrainian worm for dessert. She found herself wondering, must I do this? And then answering her own question affirmatively, as she saw the earnest look on her commanding officer's face. Oh well, she thought. It probably won't kill me. Any parasites have probably been rendered harmless by the alcohol. General Bortsov himself had the second cup with the cross on the bottom. The general smiled, placed one of the two tiny worms in his own cup and the other in Nicole's, and raised his vodka toward the ceiling of the spacecraft.
Let us all drink to a successful mission, he said. For each of us, these next few days and weeks will be the greatest adventure of our lives. In a real sense, 3 dozen are human ambassadors to an alien culture. Let us each resolve to do our best to properly represent our species.
He took the cover off his cup, being careful not to jiggle it, and then drank it all in one gulp. He swallowed the worm whole. Nicole also swallowed the worm quickly, commenting to herself that the only thing she had ever eaten that tasted worse than the worm was that awful tuber during her poro ceremony in the Ivory Coast. After several more short toasts, the lights in the room began to dim.
And now, General Bortsov announced with a grand gesture, direct from Stratford, the Newton proudly presents Richard Wakefield and his talented robots.
The room became dark except for a square meter to the left of the table that was spotlit from above. In the middle of the light was a cutaway of an old castle. A female robot, 20 centimeters high and dressed in a robe, was walking around in one of the rooms. She was reading a letter at the beginning of the scene. After a few steps, however, she dropped her hands to her sides and began to speak.
Glamis thou art, and Corda, and shalt be what thou art promised. Yet do I fear thy nature. It is too full of the milk of human kindness to catch the nearest way. Thou wouldst be great.
I know that woman, Janos said with a grin to Nicole. I have met her somewhere before.
Shh,
replied Nicole. She was fascinated by the precision in the movements of Lady Macbeth. That Wakefield really is a genius, she was thinking. How is he able to design such extraordinary detail into those little things? Nicole was astonished by the range of expressions on the robot's face. As she concentrated, the tiny stage began to swim in Nicole's mind. She momentarily forgot she was watching robots in a miniature performance. A messenger came in and told Lady Macbeth both that her husband was drawing near and that King Duncan would be spending the night in their castle. Nicole watched Lady Macbeth's face explode with ambitious anticipation as soon as the messenger had departed.
"Come, you spirits, that tend on mortal thoughts, unsex me here and fill me, from the crown to the toe, top full of direst cruelty. Make thick my blood."
My God, Nicole thought, blinking her eyes to make certain they were not playing tricks on her. She's changing. Indeed she was. As the words, "unsex me here," came from the robot, her, or its, shape began to change. The impression of the breasts against the metal gown, the roundness of the hips, even the softness of the face, all disappeared. An androgynous robot played on as Lady Macbeth. Nicole was spellbound and floating in a fantasy induced both by her wild imagination and the sudden intake of alcohol. The new face on the robot was vaguely reminiscent of someone she knew. She heard a disturbance to her right and turned to see Reggie Wilson talking avidly with Francesca. Nicole glanced back and forth quickly from Francesca to Lady Macbeth. "That's it," she said to herself. "This new Lady Macbeth resembles Francesca." A burst of fear, a premonition of tragedy, suddenly overwhelmed Nicole and plunged her into terror. "Something terrible is going to happen," her mind was saying. She took several deep breaths and tried to calm herself, but the eerie feeling would not go away. On the little stage, King Duncan had just been greeted by his gracious hostess for the evening. To her left, Nicole saw Francesca offer General Bortzoff the last sips of the wine. Nicole could not quell her panic.
"Nicole, what's the matter?" Janos asked.
He could tell she was distressed.
"Nothing," she said.
She gathered all her strength and rose to her feet.
"Something I ate must have disagreed with me. I think I'll go to my room." "But you'll miss the movie after dinner," Janos said humorously.
Nicole forced a painted smile. He helped her stand up. Nicole heard Lady Macbeth berating her husband for his lack of courage, and one more wave of premonitionary fear surged through her. She waited until the adrenaline burst had subsided, and then excused herself quietly from the group. She walked slowly back to her room.
Chapter 17. Death of a Soldier. In her dream, Nicole was 10 years old again, and playing in the woods behind her home, in the Paris suburb of Chilly-Mazarin. She had a sudden feeling that her mother was dying. The little girl panicked. She ran toward the house to tell her father. A small, snarling cat blocked her path. Nicole stopped. She heard a scream. She left the path and went through the trees. The branches scraped her skin. The cat followed her. Nicole heard another scream. When she awakened, a frightened Janos Tabori was standing over her.
"It's General Bortzoff," Janos said. "He's in excruciating pain."
Nicole jumped swiftly out of bed, threw her robe around her, grabbed her portable medical kit, and followed Janos into the corridor.
"It looks like an appendicitis," he mentioned as they hurried into the lobby, "but I'm not certain."
Irina Turgenev was kneeling beside the commander and holding his hand. The general himself was stretched out on a couch. His face was white, and there was sweat on his brow.
"Ah, Dr. Deyadan has arrived,"
he managed to smile. Bortzoff then tried to sit up, winced from the pain, and let himself lie back down.
"Nicole,"
he said quietly,
"I am in agony. I never felt anything like this in my life. Not even when I was wounded in the army."
"How long ago did it start?"
she asked. Nicole had pulled out her scanner and biometry monitor to check all his vital statistics. Meanwhile, Francesca and her video camera had moved over right behind Nicole's shoulder to film the doctor performing the diagnosis. Nicole impatiently motioned for her to back away.
"Maybe 2 or 3 minutes ago,"
General Bortzoff said with effort.
"I was sitting here in a chair watching the movie, laughing heartily, as I recall, when there was an intense sharp pain here on my lower right side. It felt as if something were burning me from the inside."
Nicole programmed the scanner to search through the last 3 minutes of detailed data recorded by the Hakamatsu probes inside Bortzoff. She located the onset of the pain, easily identifiable in terms of both heart rate and endocrine secretions.
She next requested a full dump over the time period of interest from all channels.
Janos, she then said to her colleague, go over to the supply room and bring me the portable diagnostician.
She handed Tabori the code card for the door.
You have a slight fever, suggesting your body is fighting some infection, Nicole told General Bortsov. All the internal data confirms that you are feeling severe pain.
Cosmonaut Tabori returned with a small electronic array shaped like a box. Nicole extracted a small data cube from the scanner and inserted it into the diagnostician. In about 30 seconds, the little monitor blinked and the words, 94% likely appendicitis, appeared. Nicole pressed a key, and the screen displayed the other possible diagnoses, including hernia, internal muscle tear, and drug reaction. None were, according to the diagnostician, more than 2% probable. I have two choices at this juncture, Nicole was thinking rapidly, as General Bortsov winced again from the pain. I can send all the data down to Earth for a complete diagnostic, per the procedure. She glanced at her watch and quickly computed twice the round-trip light time, plus the minimum duration of a physician's conference after the electronic diagnosis was complete, by which time it might be too late.
What does it say, Doctor?
The General was asking. His eyes were entreating her to end the pain as quickly as possible.
Most likely diagnosis is appendicitis, Nicole answered.
Damn it,
General Bortsov responded. He looked around at all the others. Everyone was there except Wilson and Takagishi, both of whom had skipped the movie.
But I won't make the project wait. We'll go ahead with the first and second sorties while I'm recuperating.
Another sharp pain jolted him, and his face contorted.
Whoa, said Nicole. It's not certain yet. We need a little more data first.
She repeated the earlier data dump, now using the extra 2 minutes of information that had been recorded since she arrived in the lobby. This time, the diagnosis read 92% likely appendicitis. Nicole was about to routinely check the alternative diagnoses when she felt the commander's strong hand on her arm.
If we do this quickly, before too much poison builds up in my system, then this is a straightforward operation for the robot surgeon, isn't it?
Nicole nodded.
And if we spend the time to obtain a diagnostic concurrence from the Earth, then my body may be in deeper trauma.
He is reading my mind, Nicole thought at first. Then she realized that the General was only displaying his thorough knowledge of the Newton procedures.
Is the patient trying to give the doctor a suggestion?
Nicole asked, smiling despite Bortsov's obvious pain.
I wouldn't be that presumptuous,
the commander answered, with just a trace of a twinkle in his eye. Nicole glanced back at the monitor. It was still blinking, 92% likely appendicitis.
Do you have anything to add? She said to Janos Tabori.
Only that I have seen an appendicitis before, the little Hungarian answered. Once, when I was a student in Budapest, the symptoms were exactly like this.
All right, Nicole said.
Go prepare Rosur for the operation. Admiral Heilmann, will you and Cosmonaut Yamanaka help General Bortsov to the infirmary, please?
She turned around to Francesca.
I recognize that this is big news. I will allow you into the operating room on 3 conditions. You will scrub, like all the surgical staff. You will stand quietly over against the wall with your camera, and you will absolutely obey any order that I give you.
Good enough, Francesca nodded. Thank you.
Irina Turgenev and General O'Toole were still waiting in the lobby after Bortsov left with Heilmann and Yamanaka.
I'm certain that I speak for both of us, the American said in his usual sincere manner. Can we help in any way?
Janos will assist me while Rosa performs the operation. But I could use one more pair of hands as an emergency backup.
I would like to do that, O'Toole said.
I have some hospital experience from my charity work.
Fine, replied Nicole. Now come with me to clean up.
Rosa, the portable robot surgeon that had been brought along on the Newton mission for just this kind of situation, was not in the same class in terms of medical sophistication as the fully autonomous operating rooms at the advanced hospitals on Earth. But Rosa was a technological marvel in its own right. It could be packed in a small suitcase and weighed only 4 kilograms. Its power requirements were low, and there were more than 100 configurations in which it could be used. Janos Tabori unpacked Rosa. The electronic surgeon didn't look much in its stowed configuration. All of its spindly joints and appendages were neatly arranged for easy storage. After Janos rechecked his Rosa user's guide, he picked up the central control box of the robot surgeon and affixed it, as suggested,
to the side of the infirmary bed where General Bortsov was already lying. His pain had only subsided a little. The impatient commander was urging everyone to hurry. Janos entered the code word identifying the operation. Rosa automatically deployed all its limbs, including its extraordinary scalpel hand with four fingers, in the configuration needed to remove an appendix. Nicole then entered the room, her hands in gloves and her body covered with the white gown of the surgeon.
"Have you finished the software check?" she said.
Janos nodded his head.
"I'll complete all the pre-operation tests while you scrub," she said to him.
She motioned for Francesca and General O'Toole, both of whom were standing right outside the door, to enter the small room.
"Any better?" she said to Bortsov.
"Not much,"
he grumbled.
"That was a light sedative I administered. Rosa will give you the full anesthetic as the first step in the operation."
Nicole had done all her memory refreshing in her room while she was dressing. She knew this operation inside out. It had been one of the surgical procedures they had performed during the test simulations. She entered Bortsov's personal data file into Rosa, hooked up the electronic lines that would bring patient monitor information to Rosa during the appendectomy, and verified that all the software had passed self-test. As her last check, Nicole carefully tuned the pair of tiny stereo cameras that worked in concert with the surgical hand. Janos came back into the room. Nicole pressed a button on the robot surgeon's control box, and two hard copies of the operations sequence were quickly printed. Nicole took one and handed the other to Janos.
"Is everyone ready?"